Bricks in the Wall of Global Greed, 17th of July 2023. When we think about the makeup of the global system, we tend to think in terms of nation-states like the USA, Britain, France and Germany, and of international institutions such as NATO and the EU. Indeed, for many years, the might of the American state has been the main physical means by which the money power has imposed its control across the world, having taken over the role once played by Britain. For this reason, many fellow anti-imperialists are rejoicing at what appears to be the collapse of this Western empire and its imminent replacement by a multipolar world order based on the BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. However, they would do well to bear in mind that a world order is still a world order, whether or not it terms itself multipolar. The poles in question are merely geographically diverse manifestations of the same overall network, and any shift in power towards BRICS can only be regarded as a manoeuvre, an internal reorganisation within the public-private global governance. This labyrinthine entity, most visible today in the form of its vanguard BlackRock financial network, has emerged from the Rothschild dynasty's long-assembled financial, industrial and institutional empire. I will here provide historical background showing how each BRICS country has long been under the influence of this worldwide power nexus, and then give a brief snapshot of their current participation in the fourth industrial revolution and Great Reset agenda promoted by the same interests. There is inevitably some overlap with previous writing, particularly my booklet on the Rothschilds' Enemies of the People, but I also present plenty of fresh and relevant material, and so I hope readers will bear with me. Brazil. The background. Brazil, of course, has never been part of the formal British Empire or Commonwealth, that foundation of today's global great racket. But in his book on the Rothschilds, Neil Ferguson explains that the London-based financiers enjoyed a, quote, traditionally close relationship, end quote, with the massive Latin American country. Brazil was heavily targeted for exploitation by the Rothschilds from the 1820s onwards, with the coffee trade forming an important aspect of their involvement. Historian Carol Quigley writes about the process of commercialization and incipient industrialization of Latin American society, which, quote, was largely a consequence of foreign investments, which introduced railroads, tram lines, faster communications, large-scale mining, some processing of raw materials, the introduction of electricity, waterworks, telephones and other public utilities, and the beginnings of efforts to produce supplies for these new activities. End quote. Notes Ferguson, quote, the long history of Rothschild involvement in Brazil shows that they did not regard formal imperial control as a precondition of profitable capital export. End quote. He reports that the Rothschilds loaned £1 million to Brazil to fund its war with Argentina and Uruguay in 1851, and afterwards came the need to finance the rapid growth of the country's railway network, which sparked a £1.8 million loan from the same source. Quote, it was just the beginning of an exceptionally monogamous financial relationship between the Brazilian government and the London House, which between 1852 and 1914 generated bond issues worth no less than £142 million, end quote, adds the historian. A lull in Brazilian government borrowing in the 1870s, with the only major issue, a £5.3 million loan in 1875, was followed by a fresh bout of activity in the 1880s, in which, quote, once again the Rothschilds acted as the government's sole issuing agent in London, end quote. Altogether, says Ferguson, the Rothschilds were responsible for Brazilian government bond issues totalling £37 million between 1883 and 1889, as well as £320,000 for the Bahia-San Francisco Railway Company. Between 1890 and 1914, the London bankers issued a staggering, which is his quote, £83 million of Brazilian public sector bonds and a further £5.8 million of private sector securities. He comments, quote, plainly, the Rothschilds had substantial financial leverage over Brazil, end quote. Indeed, during the First World War, the US ambassador in Brazil commented that, quote, the Rothschilds of Sole Mortgage Brazil's financial future, that they will place every obstacle in the way of her entering into banking relations with any other house than their own, end quote. When the Brazilian government approached the London Rothschilds in 1923 for a £25 million loan, quote, to liquidate the floating debt and set Brazilian finances in order, end quote, the bankers proposed a mission to Brazil in the hope of imposing, quote, some palatable form of foreign financial control, as they put it. Despite a spat between Brazil and Britain, the Rothschilds, quote, continued to exercise control over the coffee support scheme, writes Ferguson, and resumed their dominant role on Brazilian federal bond issues when Brazil returned to the gold standard in 1927. The Rothschild agent in Brazil, Henry Lynch, known locally as Sir Lynch after his knighthood, quote, remained a key figure in the country's finances throughout the period, end quote. Brazil's debts were at times so crippling that governments were forced to suspend repayments on several occasions, and Ferguson recalls that in the 1930s, a complete restructuring of the Brazilian debt was arranged with the Rothschilds and other foreign lenders. Quote, by issuing new bonds, the government was able to pay around £6 to £8 million annually between 1932 and 1937, though it was not until 1962 that all the sterling bonds were finally liquidated, end quote. Ferguson reports that in 1965, the Rothschilds helped raise £3 million for the Inter-American Development Bank, and in 1968, the bank, quote, organised two major loans totalling £41 million to its old client, Brazil, end quote. The present. Today, Brazil is considered an advanced emerging economy, with a GDP that is the highest in Latin America and in the top 10 worldwide. It was recently rated the ninth largest military power on the planet. Current president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, was given the World Economic Forum's first ever Global Statesman Award in 2010. And this left-winger, so-called, is so keen on Klaus Schwab's corporate pressure group that he even attended its conference on Africa in a period when he was out of office. The WEF has now opened a Centre for the Fourth Industrial Revolution in Brazil, which it says aims to, quote, encourage the adoption of new technologies and to improve Brazil's global value chains, increasing the productivity and competitiveness of Brazilian companies, end quote. This is described as a public-private partnership between the federal government of Brazil, the government of the state of Sao Paulo, and many private sector founding partners, end quote. In 2019, the Brazilian state launched a program to, quote, establish indicators and goals and implement solutions to turn Brazilian cities into smart cities, end quote. Delights in store there include CCTV cameras, face recognition, farming surveillance, and electronic health records. Impact investing is well underway in Brazil. Quote, with new investors emerging in the country and the volume of capital available for impact investing increasing, quote, according to one report, and Brazil's central bank plans to launch its digital currency in 2024. Incidentally, the Brazilian flag features the motto Ordem e Progresso, Portuguese for order and progress. This is strangely close to work, order and progress, the new motto adapted by the Macron regime in France, which at least one commentator considers thoroughly Rothschildian in tone. Russia. The background. Russia, past and present, has a reputation for being outside the financial power structures that dominate the West, but the historical facts suggest otherwise. Professor Jean Bouvier, who is a specialist in banking affairs at the Sorbonne in Paris, says Russia played a key role in the Rothschilds' multipolar, quote, financial preeminence, end quote, which he dates back to 1818. Ferguson depicts the Rothschilds at this time as being key backers of the Holy Alliance, authoritarian monarchies defending the old aristocratic order. Quote, they enabled Austria, Prussia and Russia, the members of the Holy Alliance, as well as the restored Bourbons in France, to issue bonds at rates of interest only Britain and Holland had previously been able to enjoy. End quote. The Rothschilds played a role in Russia's financial preparations for the European War over Italian independence in 1859. They're also heavily involved in a series of loans for railway building in Russia, particularly in the 1870s and 1890s. Widespread control of the railway infrastructure tied in nicely with heavy involvement in the oil industry. Historians Jerry Doherty and Jim McGregor write, quote, "The Rothschilds, behind a myriad of different company titles, constructed oil tank wagons for the railways, storage depots and refineries for the production of petrol and kerosene, and bartered with government departments over concessions and favourable rail cargo fares." End quote. They were notably involved in the Russian oil fields around Baku, now in Azerbaijan, where they, quote, "amassed vast and highly profitable investments," end quote. Immobilising vast capital in a refinery at Novorossiysk and an oil depository in Odessa, the French Rothschilds' investments in Russian oil by the end of the 19th century were worth some 58 million francs. Says Ferguson, quote, "At peak, around a third of Russian oil output was Rothschild-controlled," end quote. The Rothschilds also went into partnership with Pollack & Co., a Russian shipping firm, and the International Bank of St. Petersburg, to form a new company, Mazut, so as to expand their sales to the Russian domestic market. Relations between the Rothschilds and Russia were not always easy. Their French branch tried and failed to, quote, "establish a new Rothschild foothold," end quote, in St. Petersburg on a number of occasions. But between 1870 and 1875, the London and Paris Rothschilds jointly issued Russian bonds worth a total of £62 million, quote, "thus finally securing that influence over Russian finances which had eluded them for so long," end quote. This was also, says Ferguson, profitable business for the Rothschilds, with the price of the bonds leaping up by 24% between 1870 and 1875. In 1889, the Paris Rothschilds undertook two major Russian bond issues with a total face value of some £77 million, with the London Rothschilds joining in these operations by taking a share in a third £12 million issue in 1890. There was controversy in Russia over the terms of the 1889 Rothschild loan to the Russian Treasury, which was more costly than a previous non-Rothschild loan. Having reasserted their financial links to Russia, quote, "The Rothschilds now sought to exert pressure on the Russian government," end quote, publicly criticising its treatment of Jews. But, says Ferguson, quote, "the Rothschilds had strictly financial reasons for blowing hot and cold towards Russia," end quote. He cites in this context short-term deposits of Russian gold with the London Rothschilds and disagreements about Russian trade policy, quote, "specifically its protective tariffs on imports of rails and its new tax on oil exports." This policy was bound to be an issue, given the Rothschilds' serious involvement in both railways and oil in Russia. The Rothschilds appear to have been finally persuaded to resume financial operations with Russia by the appointment of a new finance minister, Count Witte, whose wife was reported by German diplomat Count Münster to be, quote, "an intelligent and very intriguing Jewess," quote, who was of, quote, "great help in bringing about an understanding with the Jewish bankers," end quote. Comments Ferguson, "the fact that the Rothschilds privately alluded to the Jewish origins of Witte's wife lends credibility to this interpretation," end quote. He adds that the Rothschilds may also have been, quote, "attracted by Witte's stated objective of putting Russia onto the gold standard, which accorded with their global interests in gold mining and refining." A 400 million franc Rothschild-led loan to the Russian government in 1894 was followed by another for the same sum in 1896, for which Alphonse de Rothschild was decorated with the Grand Cross by the Tsar. Finance was an increasingly important factor behind geopolitical diplomacy and war at this time. Ferguson writes, "Of all great powers, Russia relied most heavily on foreign lending in the period before 1914. And the predominance of France as Russia's main source of external finance had as its corollary a diplomatic rapprochement between the two powers. This Franco-Russian entente was one of the defining diplomatic developments of the 1890s, and the Rothschilds played a central role in it, despite their strong antipathy towards the Tsarist regime's anti-Jewish policies," end quote. In 1981, Russia took out yet another loan from a Rothschild-led consortium, this time for 425 million francs. After secretly financing the Japanese in their successful war against Russia in 1904 to 1906, and then openly lending £48 million to help build back the post-war Japanese economy, the Rothschilds also profited from the war on the Russian side. Quote, Russian industry recovered spectacularly thanks to the Rothschilds and other international bankers who poured massive loans into the country, Doherty and McGregor note. The official Rothschild attitude to the 1917 Russian Revolution and the new Bolshevik regime was negative. Says Ferguson, quote, as late as 1924, in the period of the new economic policy, Rothschild views of Soviet Russia remained so hostile as to preclude even the acceptance of a deposit from one of the new Soviet state banks, end quote. However, the socialist victory was not what it seemed. As eyewitnesses like the Russian anarchist Volin were at pains to point out, the event in fact amounted to a counter-revolution against the threat of an authentic people's revolt. The secret involvement in the Bolshevik coup of Rothschild associates, including that great British believer in the highly organised state, Alfred Milner, is well documented in Professor Anthony C. Sutton's brilliantly researched book, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution. Another important player was banker William Boyd Thompson, who in 1914 had become the first full-term director of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Thompson explains Sutton, quote, became an ardent supporter of the Bolsheviks, bequeathing a surviving symbol of this support, a laudatory pamphlet in Russian, end quote. Doherty and McGregor explain that Thompson was, quote, a loyal Morgan man, end quote, and stress that J.P. Morgan and the entire Morgan Empire were, quote, very firmly connected to Rothschild influence, end quote. They add, quote, writing in 1974, Professor Sutton was clearly unaware that virtually the entire international banking cabal was linked through a complex chain that led back to the Rothschilds in London and Paris. End quote. In addition to its role in suppressing real people power, the Soviet New Normal benefited Rothschild interests by pushing massive industrialization, including electrification dependent on their copper supplies, and by forcing peasants off the land and into factories in a manner typical of each of the industrial so-called revolutions. Quigley comments that Marxist theory was generally welcomed by the rich and powerful in Russia because it, quote, postponed revolution until after industrialization had proceeded far enough to create a fully developed bourgeois class and a fully developed proletariat, end quote. The present. Russia, the largest country in the world, today has the ninth highest population. Foreign investment and high oil prices saw the Russian economy boom at the start of the 21st century. President Vladimir Putin has a long history of involvement with the World Economic Forum, dating back to 1992, though he's not been invited to Davos since the Ukraine conflict began. In 2021, the WEF announced the opening of a centre for the Fourth Industrial Revolution in Russia, for which, quote, artificial intelligence and Internet of Things are key areas of focus, end quote. The market for solutions for smart cities in Russia exceeded 81 billion rubles at the end of 2019, says one report. Another article adds, Moscow, quote, Moscow sees the UN's Agenda 2030 as an excellent opportunity to enhance the livability of Russia's capital and transform it into a smart city, end quote. This is being boosted by Investment Strategy 2025, which is, quote, a series of reforms that aim to attract foreign investors by creating a favourable investment climate by cutting bureaucracy, end quote. Russia already boasts its own impact investing industry and is to start piloting a digital ruble in August 2023. As Moscow-based journalist Riley Wagerman puts it on his Edward Slavsquat blog, quote, yes, Russia is complicit in the Great Reset. End quote. End of part one.